Thanks a lot for this very kind introduction, Greta. I will try to talk about, what the title indicates, the linguistic and cultural dynamics of world Englishes, post-colonial Englishes, and post-colonial identity constructions. I will focus, as you can see in this preview, I will focus on, in the second part on aspects of nativization, institutionalization of new Englishes, new varieties of Englishes, in South Asia, with a particular focus on India and Sri Lanka. And in the second part, Magnus Huber will pick up on some of the theoretical bits that I will introduce in the first part, especially the Schneider model, and then we'll elaborate on his area of expertise, namely West African and Ghanaian English in particular. I will try to make my part very brief, and I hope I will be done within the next 35 or 40 minutes. Perhaps I'll skip a part towards the end of chapter 2. Let me point out, this presentation goes along with slides, and the slideshow is available to you. We just talked about before the lecture. If you're interested, we can make available the slides to you after the lecture. Now, let me begin with a often quoted definition of what we will be talking about in this lecture, namely so-called institutionalized second language varieties. I just read out this quotation from Cutshrew first and then elaborate on a few aspects here. The institutionalized second language varieties have a long history of acculturation in new cultural and geographical contexts. They have a large range of functions in the local, educational, administrative, and legal systems. The result of such uses is that such varieties have developed nativized discourse and style types and functionally determined sublanguages or registers and are used as a linguistic vehicle for creative writing in various genres. Now, the bottom line here is that in post-colonial contexts, as you are well aware of, there are new varieties of English that have come into existence based on the fact that very often in post-colonial contexts, English has been retained as an official language, is still being used for a wide range of contexts, not only for international communication, but also for intranational communication, is used in the education system, is used in newspapers, etc., etc. Although, and that's the interesting bit here, although English, for the vast majority of the people in such post-colonial contexts, English is not a mother tongue, is not the L1, but an L2 or an L3 that is a largely non-native language. This is the reason why here in this quotation, for example, the term nativized is used, not really a native language, but nativized discourse types and contexts have emerged. Institutionalized second language varieties, this is what we will be talking about, so new Englishes in post-colonial contexts, and we will talk about aspects of nativization, that is, new forms, new standards, new structures that have emerged in those new Englishes. Some people have referred to this as endonormative stabilization. Sounds complicated, but it's actually quite simple and straightforwardly clear if you think about the parts of that, the several parts of this technical term. The question really is, can we, for example, with regard to Indian English, speak of new forms, structures, standards in this new non-native variety of English that form the basis for a new Indian English standard? So is the orientation of Indian English speakers really towards their own norms and standards? Is there a model, a standard model of English that is emerging? Or is their orientation still exonormative? Are they still looking for the standards, the norms, the correct English to come from outside, that is, from British English? Now, let me introduce Cutshrew's well-known model here as a starting point. Probably many of you are familiar with this. This is taken from Yucca's Introduction to the History of English, this kind of visualization. But the essential point of this model is, I think, familiar territory. The idea really is that if we look at the history of English throughout colonization and then in the post-colonial contexts that we are talking about here, we have an inner circle, that is Cutshrew's terminology, an inner circle with varieties that are native varieties of English. For example, in the United States or in the United Kingdom, for the vast majority of the population, English is the first language, is the mother tongue, is the language that is acquired first. So inner circle varieties in those countries would be referred to traditionally as L1 varieties. Then we have the expanding circle. Let me move to the outmost circle first. Sorry. The expanding circle, which is something we are also familiar with, this is the circle in which we would locate those countries in which English is learned as a foreign language. For example, China or Russia. We could also add Germany, Japan, you name it. The interesting point about this model really is the circle in between, the outer circle. Here we would plot those countries in which English has been retained as an institutionalized second language variety, but in which English is not the L1, at least for most people it is not the L1, and this refers to post-colonial contexts like India, Singapore, Hong Kong, Ghana, and so on. Again, many, many examples. Now, this model has been criticized because it is a relatively static model, and as you can see, it is always countries that we refer to as inner circle countries, outer circle countries, or expanding circle countries. But of course, I don't read out this quotation here, which is one major criticism that has been put forward by Brutillot here. But one major point really is, and I think this is obvious, there are many countries where we can actually not take a decision on whether this country is an inner circle, an outer circle, or an expanding circle country with regard to this model. Take South Africa, for example. There is a part of the population for whom English is an L1. That would be the inner circle scenario. There are descendants of Dutch origin whose L1 is Afrikaans, for whom English is very often an L2. And there is also a large part of the population for whom English is a foreign language, a truly foreign language, only learned, as in Germany, in school. So we have all circles in one country. This nicely shows that the model in itself is rather static, and there are a lot of problems if you want to apply this model to the countries in which English is spoken as L1, L2, or learned as a foreign language. Therefore, we have many, many other models on offer, and one particular model that Magnus Huber and I are familiar with, Magnus Huber in particular because Edgar Schneider, who suggested this model, has been his, Habilitationsvater, perhaps something like that. He suggested a much more dynamic model, an evolutionary model, which is very ambitious. And we only talk here about some essential ideas of this model. If you are interested, please feel free to read about this model in more detail in his 2003 article or 2007 book. The basic idea here really is, and that makes this model very, very ambitious, the basic idea is that there is an essentially uniform pattern of evolution that underlies the formation of new Englishes worldwide, independently of whether we are talking about Africa or Asia or wherever. There is a uniform diachronic evolutionary pattern which leads to the formation of a new English variety. And this uniform diachronic pattern consists of five stages or phases. Foundation, which just means that this is the very first period in which the English language was transported to the new colonial territory. For India, we could say that from 1600 onwards, 1600 to perhaps 1750 or so, this is the foundation phase when the English language was transported to the new colonial context. Then we have a period which Schneider refers to as exonormative stabilization, where people in that new colonial territory speak English, use English, but their orientation is still towards the standards and norms from Britain. Okay, there are no local norms or standards that have already emerged. Then we have a very essential phase, nativization, where all of a sudden people start to construe also their cultural identity by means of English. So English is no longer a truly foreign language. It becomes part of the local linguistic repertoire, and it becomes more and more, if you so wish, institutionalized. Usually, there is the point in time somewhere here in the nativization period when the colony becomes independent. In India, that would have been 1947. And now the essential point really is there are two fundamentally different pathways of development. Either English is replaced by local languages. In many post-colonial contexts, this was the case. Once the colonizers are gone, there is no need to retain English. If you follow that argumentation, you just get back to your local languages for all contexts in which you would need an official language. Or people retain the English language, it retains an official status, it is used for a wide range of contexts, as for example in India and many other post-colonial contexts. And then at some point we would enter phase four, where new norms and standards emerge with local dictionaries, local grammar books that signify the emergence of local forms, the emergence of something that we would then refer to as Indian English in the Indian context or Singapore English in the Singapore context. So the idea really is that if we follow this pathway from foundation to endonormative stabilization, then at some point English becomes an integral part of the local linguistic repertoire, becomes a vehicle for local identity construction, is no longer a foreign language, and one very important symptom of this process is something that you are familiar with from literary studies, and I know that in the Ringvorlesung there were a couple of contributions that focused on this, namely the emergence of Commonwealth literature, of new English literatures, where authors use English as a non-native language for their creative fiction writing, something which is, of course, emotionally loaded. And if you have a wide range of fiction writing in English as a non-native language, say in India, for example, then, of course, this is a very strong a sign of English becoming part of local identity and part of the local linguistic repertoire. So this is the model in a nutshell from stage one to stage five, and I will be talking about Sri Lankan English and present-day English, which, as I suggested elsewhere, can be plotted on stage four in a very early phase. This is some background information on the two countries that I will be talking about. India, 3.3 million square kilometers. What is interesting here is not so much the total number of inhabitants, but the basic fact that we have hundreds of local languages that I think make it straightforwardly clear why English has been retained in the post-independence period. If you don't have any majority language, then of course it is felt to be perhaps the wisest decision to take English as the national or official language, because then it is a non-native language for everyone. There were attempts in the 60s to introduce Hindi as the one and only national language to replace English altogether, but Hindi is only spoken by 35-38% of the total population. You can easily imagine that the remaining 65-62% of the population would have felt at a disadvantage if Hindi had been introduced as the only national language for all official contexts. So this is the reason why today we have two official languages at the level of the Union of India, Hindi and English. English has been labeled the associate language. And in Sri Lanka, things are not so difficult, but on the other hand, they are more difficult. We have only two major local languages, Sinhala and Tamil. Sinhala spoken by 74% of the population, Tamil by approximately 16-18% of the population. And English, of course, it would be the easiest solution to just teach everyone or make everyone acquire Sinhala and Tamil. Easy bilingual situation, no need for English. But as you probably know, there has been a situation of civil war conditions for various centuries. There is an ethnic conflict between the two parts of the population. And that is the reason why in the late 80s, English was reintroduced as an official language in the constitution of Sri Lanka, and the label that was used in the 80s in that constitutional amendment was Link language. English as the link language, as the neutral vehicle for communication between these two parts of the population in the light of the ethnic conflict between the Sinhala and the Tamil-speaking parts of the population. Right, what you can now do is, of course, you can go through Schneider's criteria for phase four, endonormative stabilization, and then, as in a checklist, tick off with a plus sign those criteria or those parameters that are fulfilled with regard to phase four, endonormative stabilization. What you can see here, there are a couple of parameters that Schneider suggests about the historical and political situation, identity construction, sociolinguistics of contact, use, and attitudes, and what is interesting from a linguistic point of view, linguistic developments. And you can see that for most of these parameters in Indian English, we can indicate a plus. So these standards or criteria for phase four endonormative stabilization are met. For Sri Lankan English, in some cases, this is more difficult to answer. Therefore, you have a couple of question marks here. For example, question of, are the local norms, are the Sri Lankan forms of English that have emerged really accepted by the Sri Lankan speakers of English? There is a question mark here. Is there a positive attitude towards the Sri Lankan local form of English? Also a question mark. And also, is this a stabilization of a new variety? Can we say that new forms, new norms have emerged? Also a question mark. Simply because in Sri Lanka, there has hardly, what you don't find is really corpus-based empirical work on Sri Lankan English. Whereas in India, in Indian English, there have been quite a few studies on the new forms, on the new structures of Indian English. So here we can also say on the basis of previous empirical work that most people in India have a positive attitude towards the local form, they accept the local forms, and we can also say on the basis of previous studies that there is a new variety that has emerged, so it is possible to really use the label Indian English for this kind of new English variety that has emerged. There are also some early attempts at codifying the new varieties. There is a dictionary published by Nihalani et al. For Indian English. There is a very recent publication by Michael Myler, interestingly not a Sri Lankan speaker of English, but someone who works for the BBC in Colombo, who published a dictionary of Sri Lankan English. So there are early attempts at codifying these new forms, and this is, of course, a very important step towards also accepting English as part of the local linguistic repertoire. Now, if we look at the evolution of new varieties from a bird's eye perspective, then we can say that, of course, this kind of emergence of a new variety takes place at different levels. We can say there are new forms that emerge at the level of pronunciation, of phonology and intonation. You are all familiar with some of the non-native sounding intonation patterns and also deviant phonological patterns in Indian English, for example. You can easily identify an Indian English speaker because of certain phoneme replacements and stuff like that. There is a lot of stuff going on at the morphological and lexical level, of course. There are new vocabulary items that are, for example, taken over from the local languages. In Indian English, for example, you don't count in thousands and millions. You count in lakhs and crores. Also, in a newspaper article, when there is a report on the new budget plan, you will not find any figures in millions, you will find figures given in crores and lakhs. Crore is 10 million, lakh is 100,000. There are words like ticketwala, someone who sells a ticket. These are new hybrid forms that are partly taken over from the local L1s. So you can see there is a lot of creative stuff that is going on at the lexical level. There is stuff that is going on at the syntactic level, and there are also changes at the textual and stylistic level. But our research focus here in various projects is on something that has so far largely escaped linguists' attention, namely the interface between lexis and grammar. So lexicogrammar, or as some people would refer to it, morphosyntax. So the interface between lexis and grammar, verb complementation patterns, collocational patterns, and things like that. These lexicogrammatical innovations, and I will get to a couple of examples in a minute, are very important, although they have escaped, as I just said, to a very large extent, linguists' attention so far. They are important because they reflect to a very large extent the degree of structural nativization. I mean, if English is transported to a new context, it is, I think, straightforwardly clear that new vocabulary items are coined, simply because English is now used in a new context. There are local languages. There is a lot of loan translation going on, borrowing, words are taken over. This is stuff that you are familiar with also from the history of English. If you think of the Middle English period, of course, when French was transported to England, many French words were taken over. This is something very natural, nothing surprising. And also that there are changes at the level of pronunciation and phonology, also not surprising, and in a sense also predictable. But what is interesting is the lexis grammar interface, and this is what Schneider says about the very importance of changes at this very interface between lexis and grammar. He says, quote, many of the characteristic innovations of post-colonial Englishes can be located at this boundary between lexis and grammar. They concern the co-occurrence potential of certain words with other words or specific structures. A classic example is the complementation patterns which verbs and also adjectives typically enter. In new varieties, for example Indian English, in the process of structural nativization, verbs begin to allow and later prefer new structures to complement them and build a complete sentence. An example. This is taken from a previous study of ours where we compared the verb complementation patterns of a high-frequency verb like give in two comparable corpora. ICE stands for International Corpus of English, 1 million words in size, 60% spoken, 40% written, and the beauty of this corpus is that the 20 or so national subcomponents, including the British component and the Indian component, have exactly the same design. So you can use these national components for statistical, quantitative comparisons, because they are comparable. And what you see is, as you all know, give is a verb that can enter various complementation patterns. It can be used in the type 1 pattern, the ditransitive pattern, give someone something. It can also be used in the type 2 pattern, the prepositional dative, give something to someone. It can also be used and is used frequently in a monotransitive pattern. I'm giving a lecture, full stop. This is a monotransitive pattern. The recipient is left out. Okay, this would be type 3. And what you can see from the figures here is that there are different preferences for the different complementation patterns in the two varieties. And this is, and that's a very important point I would like to drive home, corpus-based research is very important here because at the lexis grammar interface we are very often not dealing with categorical differences. We are not dealing with a situation where form A is used in variety X and form B is used in variety Z. Very often what we have is forms A and B are used both in variety X and in variety Y, but the frequencies are different. There are different preferences, and this is also part of variety formation, and you can only describe this on the basis of large amounts of authentic data, namely corpora. I won't go into details about corpus linguistics. Some of you are in my lecture on this this semester, and I won't torture you with that in this lecture. The bottom line here is, and Schneider refers to results like this, to emphasize this very point, these are stable and noteworthy results. And it is worth pointing out that they operate way below the level of linguistic awareness. Without quantitative methodology, on the basis of corpora, no observer would have expected such differences to exist. And this is the kind of research we are carrying out in various research projects on the basis of corpora, the description and analysis of quantitative differences between varieties. and then trying to find reasons why we have those quantitative differences. This is, of course, the daunting task to actually find explanations for these quantitative differences. What I would like to focus on in the remainder of my part today is not this kind of quantitative research into statistical differences with regard to different preferences between varieties. I would like to focus here on some examples of genuinely new forms, because these low-frequency new forms are also important. They indicate what I wish to call the creative force of a new variety. This is an essential point of variety formation that L2 speakers of English as an institutionalized second language variety feel at ease with the English language and feel therefore free to also introduce entirely new forms, new structures, are innovative in their use of English. And some of these new low-frequency phenomena can be detected by using large amounts of data, corpora, but of course we will only find very few instances, but these few instances are also interesting for the description of variety formation and identity construction, because it is only if you feel comfortable with an institutionalized, nativized L2 that you would introduce new forms and that these new forms would also be accepted by local speakers of that new variety. A couple of examples. New prepositional verbs. What you see here is again a comparison of two components of ICE, ICE India, ICE GB. This is the design of the corpora that I just mentioned, so they are comparable. And what you can see interestingly is that there are a couple of new prepositional verbs, new meaning, that we find them in new varieties like Indian English, but they are, unsurprisingly so, not attested in ISGB, which historically is the input variety for Indian English. Not many instances, but interesting instances. Approach to, comprise of, discuss about, order for, visit to. Couple of examples, all of them taken from ICE India. Approach to the higher authorities, where in native varieties of English, people would prefer a prepositionless variant. The preposition would be less left out. The train will comprise of 40 vans. Probably in British English, the variant that would be preferred would be consist of. Discussing about, again, in British English, the preposition would be left out. Order for, visit to. What this indicates really is that in Indian English, competent speakers of English as L2 introduce new forms, and the question now is how come these new forms are introduced? Are there linguistic reasons that we can give? Yes, there are. A lot of this can be explained by drawing on mechanisms of analogy. We have called this in various publications nativized semantico-structural analogy. I read out the definition first, then go back to the examples and explain what we mean by this. We mean a process by means of which non-native speakers of English as a second language are licensed to introduce new forms and structures into the English language because corresponding semantic and formal templates already exist in the English language system. So what Indian English speakers basically do is they work in a creative way with material that is already existent in, if you so wish, British English, but extend certain regularities to new forms. But it's an entirely rational process based on analogy. If you take the example, now when you ordered for the beer, then you could argue, as in all the other examples on this slide and the previous slide, you could argue that there are semantic and formal templates that already exist in British English. There is, for example, the frequent collocation, the noun order plus the preposition for. It's a very frequent word combination, the noun order plus the preposition for. This is a formal template that already exists. So in a sense, it is perfectly rational to extend this collocational pattern to the verb order. And of course, there is a semantic pattern, namely the semantically similar verb ask for, in which the preposition for is also used. So in a sense, you could argue that Indian English speakers, on the basis of analogy, introduced the new prepositional verb order for as some kind of creative derivation on the basis of formal and semantic templates that already exist in English. And you can toy around with the other examples in a very similar way and explain them on the basis of analogy. Same holds true for what we have labeled new ditransitive verbs. This is very interesting because there are a couple of verbs in new varieties of English, like Indian English, that can be used in the ditransitive pattern, but that are no longer admissible in the ditransitive pattern in present-day British English. Some of them were once admissible in the ditransitive construction, but are no longer. This is again something that is entirely understandable and explicable on the basis of analogy. By the way, this also happens all the time in British English and native varieties of English in general. Take things like cry me a river. Of course, intuitively, if you were asked, you would probably all say cry is a prototypical intransitive verb. You would not come up with cry as a ditransitive verb, at least not a prototypical ditransitive verb. But as you can see, cry can be used in the ditransitive pattern with two objects, of course with a metaphorically extended meaning. Or Grisham, this is taken from Grisham, she now had him a room in the basement. If you look at the BNC, a corpus of 100 million words of English, you don't find a single example of have in the ditransitive pattern. It is very, very unusual, but it can be used. It is something creative, something unusual, and it happens all the time in native language use as well. Now, what non-native speakers of Indian English as an L2 variety do is basically the same. On the basis of analogy, they create new ditransitive verbs like convey, furnish, gift, inform, present. I also added provide here, but provide is also present to some extent. Are verbs that are perfectly admissible as ditransitive verbs, provide by all means and present increasingly so in American English. They are not attested in ISGB, but provide in American English can be used in the ditransitive pattern without any problems. This is institutionalized, but in ISGB you don't find any instances. But if you focus on convey, furnish, gift, inform, usually in native varieties you would not expect these verbs to occur in the ditransitive pattern. In examples like those, can you furnish me Dr. Shastri's address? The envoy also conveyed the French Prime Minister Mr. Rocker's invitation to Mr. Xin. You gifted me two such wonderful hours today. If you look up gift in the Oxford English Dictionary, there is only one tiny little exception where gift can be used as a ditransitive verb, namely in the context of sports. X gifts Y a ball. This is the only context which is attested in the OED. It is very unusual as a ditransitive verb in other contexts, for example, in contexts like those. I'll take an example like inform me the final and exact schedule. This is no longer grammatical in present-day British English. In brackets, it was grammatical in the 19th century in British English, but was then no longer used at some point and is no longer admissible in present-day British English. But as you can see, it is used in Indian English and is not a case of superstrate retention. That is to say, inform me the final and exact schedule is nothing that Indian English speakers have retained from an old stage of British English, but they have reintroduced this as a new form, as a new creative form. We showed this in a previous study on the basis of corpus data. Now, let me skip a couple of things and give you one more example of creative innovations, but now in a different variety. This is now taken from Sri Lankan English. And some of you may know from the corpus linguistics lecture that we have an ongoing project where we compile very, very large newspaper corpora of standard varieties of South Asian Englishes including 6 varieties: Indian English, Pakistani English, Sri Lankan English, Bangladeshi English, Nepali English, and Maldivian English. Each corpus will be 3 million words in size. And what we hope to do is, by comparing these 6 components, to describe quantitative differences between these 6 varieties at the level of verb complementation. This refers to the give example that I gave at the beginning. But also to dig out examples like those where we can really trace low-frequency creative forms that are in the process of emerging. So this refers to the examples that I mentioned towards the end, new ditransitive verbs, new prepositional verbs, that indicate the creative force of a new variety of English. I gave you a couple of examples from Indian English, and if you're interested, I would welcome you to contact us, and we could give you more information on studies, on publications where we report on other innovative forms. But I would like to wrap this up with one example from Sri Lankan English, because this can be explained in a very different way. Take a call in the sense of make a call. This is nothing we find in any other South Asian variety of English. So it is not the case that all South Asian varieties are the same. Some people speak of South Asian English, but if you look closely at the 6 varieties, you will find many, many differences between the 6 varieties, so it makes sense to differentiate between the 6 varieties. Take a call in the sense of make a call, as in those examples. When he comes to take a phone call to my aunt's house, in the sense of make a call, actively making a call, not receiving a call. Take a telephone call to our coach, in the sense of make a call to our coach, not receiving a call. How can this be explained? How come this only is attested in the Sri Lankan data? If it only occurs in the Sri Lankan data, then the obvious explanation is it has something to do with the local languages, interference from the local languages. And in fact, this can be explained in such a way, because in Sinhala and Tamil, we have, in both languages, we have a verb that is the equivalent to English take, and that is used with the same meaning in those 2 local languages, namely gane in Sinhala and eduke in Tamil. And this kind of pattern of gane and eduke, in this pattern, with this meaning, is transferred to English. So here, on the basis of interference or negative transfer from local languages, we can explain why this new use of take a call with this new meaning is only attested in Sri Lankan English, but not in other South Asian varieties of English. Right. Let me come to my interim conclusion here on the basis of the conceptual considerations and also the various examples that I mentioned. I hope to have shown that, in general, the Lexis-Grammar interface, the interaction between words and complementation patterns, using verbs as prepositional verbs with prepositions, using verbs in complementation patterns, using verbs in new light verb constructions like take a call in the sense of make a call, that this Lexis-Grammar interface is a very interesting and relevant area of research, and there is a lot of work to be done with regard to this interface, and you can do this only on the basis of corpora, and this is where the difficult point comes into play. You have to compile the corpora first, and then you can analyze them, and for many of the new Englishes worldwide, no such standard corpora are available. Second, I think it is necessary to describe and compare on the basis of corpus data structural nativization at the lexicogrammatical level in all South Asian Englishes. And what I think is very, very important also for the description of identity construction and for the description of the linguistic exponents of new identities in post-colonial contexts is also to look for these unusual creative forms and structures, because they indicate the creative force of new speech communities who use English as a non-native language, not only for fiction writing, but also for a wide range of contexts in that post-colonial context. And mind you, we are not talking about pidgin English here. We are talking about the usage of competent, acrolectal speakers of a standard variety of English that usually have gone through English medium instruction at school and university. And what needs to be done in many cases is really complement these corpus-based studies with research into what speakers in those post-colonial contexts think about these new forms. Very often, and this brings me to the end of my part, very often you can notice something that is also interesting for cultural identity construction. You can notice something that Katschul has referred to as linguistic schizophrenia. If you ask an Indian English speaker, do you think there is a local variety that has emerged, he or she will probably say yes. If you ask the same speaker, what kind of English do you yourself speak, then most half of the speakers will say, of course, what I speak is British English, which is rubbish. And if you ask the third question, what is the norm or standard that you would like to approximate to, what is the kind of model that should be taught in India, given that there is a local model of English that has already emerged, most people would say it should be British English, which is also rubbish, because there is a local variety of English that has emerged. Katschul has referred to this as linguistic schizophrenia, and it nicely shows that there is a lot of tension between different aspects of identity construction. People not always identify themselves wholeheartedly with the colonizers' language that they have retained for various reasons. Thank you so much for my part, and we'll hand over to Markus.